Good morning. This is Larry Warren, and it's time for Mountain Money. Lacking our theme music this morning, Doug and I will hum the theme song.
I don't know. We might lose some listeners if we do.
Let's not do that. But welcome to Mountain Money. It's 9:06, and this is when we talk about the world of business, finance, investing, all those sorts of things, and we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about it with Dan Ward, first of all, who we've had on Mountain Money before with another book he authored, and this time he's out with one called The Simplicity Cycle, and we'll tell you more about Dan as we go along. Warm day expected today, looking for a high of 81, and with those warm temperatures, chance of afternoon thunderstorms blowing up every afternoon. Got mighty dark yesterday afternoon.
It got mighty dark, but we didn't get any rain. I actually had to turn on my sprinklers for the first time, so made it to June 15th without putting on the sprinklers, which is a first in the 10 years I've lived here.
Yeah, great news, and we may get some lawn sprinkling this afternoon. 30% chance of scattered thunderstorms, and tonight a 50% chance, so pretty good chance something may happen later in the day. And after Dan Ward, we're going to bring the focus locally.
We are, yeah. We've got Mark Pittman, who's the CEO of Blinksy. He is a recent University of Utah Law School and MBA grad and also an entrepreneur. He's developed a clever device. Larry, you may have seen it. There's about 12 white boxes throughout Park City. And what it's doing is it's monitoring our cell phone data, essentially, to give the city an idea of our traffic that we're seeing in town. So they're not listening in on conversations.
They're not sending it off to the NSA.
This is not Big Brother. This is really a good use of data, which is to see how people are traveling around Park City. It's really clever technology. And our final guest, everybody here is familiar with the Treasure Mountain Inn at the top of Main Street. That is owned by Andy Berman and Thea Leonard. And they are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Treasure Mountain Inn, and we're going to have them in to talk about that. So stay tuned. It'll be a good show. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. We have Dan Ward on the line with us. Dan is a repeat guest. We had him on when his book Fire, FIRE, How Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained, and Elegant Methods Ignite Innovation. That was a couple of years ago. Now he's out with The Simplicity Cycle. A little bit about Dan. He was for more than 20 years an acquisition officer for the U.S. Air Force. He's an engineer by training, and specialized in leading high-speed, low-cost technology development programs for the military. Retired as a lieutenant colonel, is now a business consultant and author of books like The Simplicity Cycle. Dan, welcome back to Mountain Money.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks so much for having me on the show again. It's good to be back.
Well, thanks for calling in, and let's talk about the new work, and basically this is a book about design. It's about creating a roadmap for designing new products, services, business models, and how to keep things simple and not overly complex. That's my simple description. Why don't you give the your version of the simple description?
That's a great summary. Yeah, the book, The Simplicity Cycle, is really about helping readers make good decisions about complexity in the things we design and in the things we use. So whether we're making something or whether we're really on the consumer side of picking something, I'm going to buy this versus that, complexity has a big role to play in how good a thing is, the value, the usability, and the functionality of the things that we make and build. And again, whether we're talking about a PowerPoint presentation, a piece of software, a piece of hardware, And so what I try to do with the book is help equip my readers with some tools and some techniques that we can use, again, very simple things to help us make good decisions about complexity in the world around us. So it's full of stories that hopefully make people laugh and make people think at the same time. There's one about the time I completely failed at building a Lego robot when I was in grad school. There's a story about a brownie that's more complicated than a fighter jet, and kind of everything in between. So it's a very fun book to write, and hopefully it's a fun book to read.
Well, and you used to lead fairly complex projects for the Navy, and you have a story. In 2002, you were pitching a project to a lieutenant commander, and she surprised you when she started the meeting with a statement. Tell us what her statement was, and where do you think that came from?
I did, and in fact, that scene, which I describe in the book, was really the origin of this, what eventually became the Simplicity Cycle. I'd come in to present her with some technology that I've been working on, and she stopped me before I even got started and said, "Wait, if this isn't easy to use, I don't want it. I'm not interested." And it was sort of rocked me back a little bit, and I realized that what she was saying was that ease of use mattered more to her than all the shiny widgets and functions and features that I might have thrown into this particular piece of technology. As it turns out, the system I brought in to demonstrate that day was easy to use, and she did like it, and they did go on to use that in her organization.
Why do you think it was so important to her that she started the meeting with that?
I think she'd seen a lot of people come in and pitch and present technologies that were not easy to use, and they tended to be the result of engineers and designers and kind of senior decision makers who view complexity as a sign of sophistication, and they'll come in and brag, "This is the most complicated thing we've ever built." And I think she wanted to sort of head that off of the pass and not waste any more time with technologists and people who overvalued complexity, because in her case, she really valued simplicity and ease of use. The way she phrased it in that particular way really set me on a path that led to doing some deep analysis into from an engineering perspective of what makes a thing good, and how do we make good decisions about complexity. So really, I owe a lot. I owe this entire book to Lieutenant Commander Jenny Soto, wherever she is now.
on this show, it's always Doug Wells who very quickly somehow makes an analogy to Apple
computer.
But I'm beating you to it today, Doug. For me, an example was DOS computing back in the early 80s. The first home PCs were coming on, and you had to understand how to type in very complicated to a neophyte commands. And then Apple came along and said, We'll run all that in the background. All you do is take this pointer and click on a picture of what you want to do." I mean, that to me is an example of the simplicity cycle, making things as simple as they can be, even if they're complex in the background.
Absolutely. I mean, Apple has really made a career and a business out of emphasizing simplicity, and simplicity as a design aesthetic, in a sense, simplicity as something that's appealing. And so they really the inverse of what Commander Soto had kept running up against. Rather than as a sales point, "Hey, this is a really complex system, therefore it must be good, and therefore you should like it and buy it," Apple has taken the reverse and said, "This is very simple. Therefore, it is good, and therefore you should buy it."
Yeah,
and that seems to work out all right. They're
making
a pretty decent product.
And in the design process, that's one thing you talk about is start stripping away things that are added on, and see when you get back to the point at which the product itself is compromised.
Yeah, I talk about two different approaches to doing design. One sort of the additive approach, and the other is a reductive approach. And it's important to understand both approaches to design. Sometimes when we add things, we make it better. You add words to your PowerPoint chart, and it now communicates an idea that it didn't communicate before. But it's also possible to do creation by subtraction. And this idea of a reductive design approach, creation by subtraction, may sound counterintuitive, but it's exactly what a sculptor does. You take a big block of material, and you chip away all the parts you don't want to keep, sweep away all the little chips and sawdust, and what you end up with is something that has more value but less physical substance. You know, you've removed some of the stone, removed some of the wood, whatever medium you're working in, and it's that removal that is the creative process. Dan, and you can do the same thing with software and words and you know, presentations and things like that.
You know, it's interesting you bring up software. I'm learning to program and code. I'm 50 years old and just decided this is a space that's going to be with us, obviously, for a very long time. It's going to become increasingly important. And one of the nice things on software is when you have to build all of the features yourself, you really learn the additive process, and you very quickly learn what are the fewest features I need to have in order to make this idea functional. And I think that's a good discipline to have. So software might be an example where you start with the additive process. Could you give us examples of when one process, additive versus taking away, how people should think about when to use one process versus the other?
Sure. So early on in the project, when you don't have a lot on your plate just yet, you have maybe a blank sheet of paper and you're beginning to identify what does this project need to do, what message does it need to communicate, what function does it need to provide. Early on, that's when we tend to use an additive approach. So we're introducing new pieces, parts, and functions, and each of these additions makes the thing better. That becomes problematic when we kind of go beyond that critical mass of complexity where, you know, you get to a point where each new addition actually begins to contribute less than the previous. And not only that, we end up with negative returns. Each addition starts to make the thing worse. More failure modes, it gets harder to test, it gets harder to use, it tends to cost more, it tends to weigh more, it tends to take longer. And when you hit that phase, now we begin to do that reductive approach where we start to trim out the things that maybe were a good idea to add in the first place, but now it's an equally good idea to remove it. So Microsoft went through that with Windows Vista. If you put Windows Vista on a laptop, there were 15 ways to shut that thing down. Now, there's probably a good idea for each of those mechanisms to, you know, sleep, hibernate, and 13 others. Probably a good idea for a good reason to have each one, but there was no good reason to have all 15. So after Windows Vista, they came out with Windows 7, which was a much more simplified, streamlined design. It was more reliable. It was less buggy. It was easier to use. So less confusing for users.
I'm sure the engineers at Microsoft now have a word for diminishing returns. It turns out in the English language, we really don't have a single word, but in the German language, they do. What is that word, and why do you think the Germans have that in their vocabulary?
Yeah, there's a wonderfully complex German word that I mentioned in the book. I'm probably going to pronounce it horribly, but it's Verschlimmbesserung, and it means improvements that make things worse. And that is the design efforts, the design steps we take to improve a design, to make things better, that end up backfiring on us. They end up actually decreasing the value, decreasing the goodness of the thing that we're working with. A friend of mine, who was actually a lieutenant colonel in the German Army, he and I talked about this quite a lot, and sort of he introduced me to this word. And you're right, there's no equivalent other than to have the idea of something backfiring on us. But there's no English equivalent to this exact concept. But that's why the subtitle to my book, The Simplicity Cycle, is How to Make Things Better Without Making Them Worse.
And you're talking, we're not talking about this principle, the simplicity cycle, about just manufacturing goods. But it applies equally in the service sector applies equally in processes of how you run a business, how you conceive a new business.
For sure, and I've been pleasantly surprised at how many lawyers really like this book and respond well to it, and some of my clients are really more in the law area and legislation and trying to figure out how do we improve our laws that we're writing or laws that we practice through simplicity rather than just adding, you know, an increase in complexity. But yeah, it's the kind of thing you can apply this to a process design, to an organizational structure, as well as to, you know, building a spaceship or a nuclear-powered submarine.
You know, it's unfortunate, and your last statement kind of alludes to it. We're kind of wired as humans to like complexity, especially when we're an expert in an area. Although it does work against us. You tell a story about an inventor in your book, who most of us have never heard of. You reminded me, I had heard the story before, but you reminded me of Wycombe Judson, who was an inventor and liked complex things. But as he started to follow the principles that you talk about here in your book, obviously a century before your book, Tell us about Whitcomb and the result of his changed way of thinking and what that resulted in.
Sure. So the guy who invented the zipper was famous for well, even his friends described that the things he designed tended to cause more problems than they solved. Which is, you know, that's what your friends are saying. You can't imagine what his critics were saying. So he was famous for coming up with very complex, very difficult, very problem-inducing inventions. But he eventually did sort of manage to make it over the hump and figured out a way to simplify what he called a clasp locker, which we all know now as a zipper. That is so simple a child can use it. In fact, it's one of the easiest types of fasteners that, you know, kids can use, much easier than trying to do buttons and snaps. And really, if you look at his design process of the iterations he went through as he tried different approaches and different designs, you can see this initial increase in complexity, and then he kind of hit a peak and began to simplify. And once he went over that peak and began to simplify, that's when things really got powerful and impressive.
You know, and a guy who epitomized illustrating that has kind of faded from pop culture today, but I remember as a kid looking at drawings of Rube Goldberg, and even today they're called a Rube Goldberg way of doing things, which is probably a reference that's lost on younger people. But he was famous for taking a simple task and making it as impossibly complicated as humanly possible.
In fact, Dad, as you describe your robot challenge in your book, that's what I was reminded of, is the Ruby Goldberg challenge. You guys turned a simple project into something similar to that.
Right, yeah. Rube Goldberg's, his diagrams were hilarious, and they show how to exert maximum effort to get minimal results. And my favorite story in the book is actually a little bit embarrassing story. It's when I was in grad school, and we had an assignment to build a autonomous robot out of a little Lego Mindstorm kit, and we did exactly that. If a thing could be done in one step, we did it in four steps. And on demonstration day, our robot was supposed to navigate this little maze. We failed on our first attempt and our second attempt and our third attempt. Ours was just, it was huge, it was complicated, it kept falling apart, and it just absolutely didn't work. One of the other teams in my class, the team that did the best, theirs used two wheels. Everybody else has used four. I think ours used six. They had like seven lines of code to run this thing. We had dozens of lines. And so we watched theirs go through that maze really fast, like it hardly bumped into the walls at all. And it was just this great illustration of the cost of complexity and the benefits of a simple design. So we quickly did a redesign on our effort. We stripped out a bunch of stuff and eventually did make it through the design, and I passed the class, but boy, just barely.
So Dan, you're humble and share that story in your book. That's an example of where things didn't go well. You know, one of the things that's inspirational to me about your book is just the fact that you do work for the military. We don't have many authors that come out of the military. We've had a few typically talk about leadership more than the topic we're talking about this morning. And there's the famous stories of, you know, the $700 hammer that goes on a aircraft. You've got some really impressive places that you've worked, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Tell us what you're seeing. What is the government doing? Are they getting better at that kind of stuff? Are the days of the $700 hammers behind us?
You know, I'm not sure that the newspapers and headline writers ever got that story quite right, but yes, there certainly were issues where we spent a lot more time and money than necessary. And that's a pretty longstanding trend in military technology, that things tend to cost more, take longer, and do less than was promised. Having said that, there's been a lot of progress. We do see a fair number of systems that don't get all as much attention from the brass or from the press, systems that deliver ahead of schedule and under budget and do more than anyone expected them to do. And I've been very fortunate to work on a number of those projects, to include a little radar project, which is my last project on active duty. It was about an $84 million program, which makes it one of the smallest projects in my particular, in my office and my boss's portfolio. We finished up a month ahead of schedule. We had $8 million left over. We were $8 million under budget, which was just an exciting project to go out on. But the really fascinating thing is we did it in about 2 years. a lot of external experts said, hey, you know, we recommend don't even try this project. It should take 7 years to do this. And we did it in two and had a bunch of money left over. So, but again, you're probably not going to find that, you know, that's not going to make the front page of any newspaper. All we did was, you know, quickly and inexpensively deliver a meaningful capability that, you know, does more than anybody expected it could do. But those stories are out there. And part of what I try to do in my books and in my writing and speaking is shine a light on some of those instances to just sort of say, hey, it can be done, it has been done, here's what right looks like. Here's examples of the good news stories that don't often get as much attention as they should.
Tell us one of your favorites from the book.
One of my favorites from the book, I love a story about an autonomous robot sailboat named Honey Badger that was designed to sail around the world without a crew. What I love about that particular story is it's one of the few that I could find in my research where they actually, the guys who invented it really went into detail about their design approach. And one of the key things they did was they introduced a little tail on the back of the main sail. And this tail allowed the computer to basically control the orientation of the sail without using ropes, without using winches, and without using a person on board. And boy, as soon as you, by introducing this one small piece, they were able to remove a lot of other pieces. And as soon as you take the people off the boat, now you don't need to carry food or water or a place to sleep, and it simplifies the operation of the thing tremendously. So Honey Badger went on to win a bunch of awards and set all kinds of records. And so that idea of that one special piece, that one addition that led to a bunch of other subtractions, I think is a great example of a design pattern that actually happens fairly regularly, but we don't often have a word for it. We're not aware of it. So, you know, when we kind of look for those opportunities to introduce those special pieces, that one key piece that gives you a great new capability, we can find them much more often if we know to look for them in the first place.
You know, in the course of this conversation, I'm reminded of a news story I covered years ago, which I guess illustrates the... I don't know what it illustrates, except human failure in the course of design. And that's, I don't know if you're familiar with a NASA small project, meaning it was only $400 million, I think.
Right.
To Genesis, I think was the name of it. And they flew a satellite to as close to the sun as anything has ever flown and brought it back. And the idea was to capture particles of the solar wind and bring them back to Earth. And it was to land in Utah, and it was to land under a parachute, and then because the wafers that collected the solar wind particles were so fragile, it was to land under a parachute, and a helicopter was to snatch it out of the air and lift it gently to the Earth. And you think about the complicated parts of that process. It's to send something to the sun and bring it back and have it land on the exact piece of ground in Utah that you want it to. And everything went well, and we were all there for the arrival of this from the sun. And it came in hot because the parachutes didn't deploy. And when they went, so the whole thing crashed and smashed on the desert floor, right where it was supposed to, but
a little deeper than
but at terminal velocity instead of a half mile an hour. And when they did the analysis of it, the switch to deploy the parachute was wired backwards. They had two wires and they were put on backwards. So I don't know what that little story illustrates other than you can do everything right, and things are still going to go wrong if a human is involved.
Right. I think that illustrates a couple points. One is that failure is inevitable. No matter how lucky you are, how talented you are, how dedicated you are, at some point, things are not always going to go our way, and so failures happen. So one of the things we want to do is sort of mitigate or constrain the impact of our failures. The other thing that illustrates, I think, is that the more complicated our system is, the harder it is to really debug it, the harder it is to make sure that everything is correct. And when you have, you know, thousands of lines of code, for example, it's that much harder to find a problem in those lines of code than if you only have 10 lines of code. Same thing if you have, you know, hundreds of switches, it'll take you a long time to check all the switches. If you only have two or three, you can confirm that those are correct pretty quickly. So, you know, certainly that kind of thing happens, but that story reminds me of Mars's Stardust mission, which was sort of similar. The idea was to fly through the tail of a comet, collect some particles, and return those to Earth. And that one actually did have a safe and soft landing in the desert in Utah, I believe, and pretty amazing success with that one. I think they flew 3 billion miles, if I recall. And again, this is the first time anyone had ever tried to fly through the tail of a comet. But when I spoke with the program manager for that project, he kept talking about this as a very simple spacecraft. He said, look, we have three requirements. Fly through the tail of a comet, collect some particles, and bring them home. Everything else is you know, a bonus. And so this idea of three core requirements really provided focus to the team. What problems are we going to solve? Where are we going to direct our energies and our efforts? And again, Stardust was a huge success for NASA.
Yeah, and it's stories like that are very inspirational. I think it's part of the value. Yes, the information these spacecrafts bring back, but it just shows what's possible when a team of people get together. They've been well trained, they're dedicated, they work hard, and they double check everything. It's just amazing what can be done, and hopefully it's inspirational to some kids that are thinking about what to do when they go to college and for their careers afterwards. Dan, we need to wrap up, but I do want to give you a chance to talk about something that's in your About the Author section. Like I mentioned, we don't have many military personnel on as guests. This is a business show. And the military there's business aspects of it, as you bring out to your book. I want to thank you for your service and your one paragraph summary of your background talks about that you're the recipient of a Bronze Star Medal for your service in Afghanistan. I was hoping we could close with you sharing with us the story. How did you end up earning the Bronze Star?
Sure. I appreciate the question. I was in Afghanistan from November of 2011 through May of 2012, and I led a small team of international officers. We had a guy from the Czech Republic, one from Croatia, one from Romania, one from Canada. I even had a U.S. Navy guy, and he's practically from another country as well. Our group was responsible for handling transportation, security, and billeting for VIPs from NATO countries coming into theater. So our job was basically to make sure they had a safe and successful time in Afghanistan, got them where they needed to go, and made sure they got there as safely as possible. By the time it was all over, we had had, I don't remember how many VIPs we had come through, but heads of state, Secretary of Defense equivalents from different NATO countries. And for that work, I suppose, the Army went ahead and pinned a Bronze Star on me. So that was a nice capstone to my time over there.
It sure is. It's a nice honor. Our guest this morning has been Dan Ward. He is the author of The Simplicity Cycle, A Field Guide to Making Things Better Without Making Them Worse. He is also a retired lieutenant colonel, sorry about that, Dan, in the U.S. Air Force. Dan, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. It was great to chat with you both.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about those little white boxes that are monitoring our movements around town. We'll be back with more Mountain Money after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Looking for products and services in the Park City area? Look no further than the business directory on the Park City Chamber Bureau website. Visit parkcity.com. It features over 1,000 businesses, from accountants and electricians to painters, window cleaners, and much more. Our member businesses provide the Park City area with products and services our community needs. Again, all this information can be found at visitparkcity.com. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Larry, I always enjoy hearing stories about how the federal government works and the military, and you know it's easy to take pot shots at those large organizations, but the reality is there are a tremendous number of really good people doing great work.
Indeed, and Dan Ward has proven his value both in his career and outside of it now as a business consultant.
So we're gonna switch gears now. We tease the audience at the open. There are a dozen or so white boxes popping up around town. And the purpose of those white boxes is to give us more information about the visitors that are coming, where they're going, where they're stopping, and hopefully help us with traffic. In studio with us now is Mark Pittman. He's the CEO of Blinksy, entrepreneur and recent graduate of the University of Utah, both MBA program and law school program. Mark, thanks for coming in. And with him is Matt Abbott. He is an environmental project engineer for Park City Municipal. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, good morning.
So, Matt, let's start with you. What was happening in Park City that led you to want to have more information about how traffic is working in Park City?
Well, everyone probably remembers the big traffic.
We have a day. Name for it, don't we? Trafageddon, isn't it? We've coalesced around that.
You know, humans are funny with data. We make a lot of assumptions. And so as a city, we're always trying to figure out how to attach real data to what's actually going on so we can solve the problems most effectively. And we do all sorts of things around traffic and parking and monitoring and big studies. And what Blinksy has is kind of an interesting, more real-time approach to that data. And we're hoping to get some great information from it.
Okay. And that's, Mark, that's a great lead-in for you. What does Blinksy do, and how can your technology help Park City?
Yeah, so Blinksy is really a big data solution to the biggest problems that cities, municipalities, and even regular citizens face every day. So you're going about your life, and you're creating data and traffic, really, right? So you're stopped at the light. There's people behind you who can't get through because you're stopped at that light. The light's green or it's red. We don't know why it's green or why it's red, where you're coming from, how long you're going to be there, where you've been before. And the way you impact the traffic grid and the way everybody else impacts the traffic grid is important for city planners and municipalities, especially to understand how to better plan for the future, where you need a stoplight, where you don't need a stoplight, whether to increase the road size or not increase the road size, what happens when there's a special event in the city, anything like that. So Blinksy, we're really taking the approach of doing real-time traffic studies all over the city in real time, providing that information to cities and municipalities to give them more insight into what to do and how to react to that system.
And how does the city do cities typically do that now, and how do you do it?
Yeah, so a lot of it's sort of a backwards approach, right? It's relying heavily on complaints from citizens that this stoplight is way too is red way too long, or that I don't like the intersection on, you know, First and Fifth or whatever it is. But there's also this approach of, you know, laying those little strips across the road that you drive over that you see every so often. They're fairly expensive, labor-intensive. You've got to lay it down. It breaks fairly easy. And it's not super accurate because you don't know how many people are in that car. You don't know if there's cyclists coming across, how many pedestrians are in that area. So Blinksy takes the approach of doing a way more comprehensive study of actually using your connected devices to tell us where you are and what you're doing without any connection to who you are as a person. Our data is completely anonymized. There's no way for us to relate that back to you. And we really give that information to the city then to make some insight from.
And so it's all based on the ping that goes out from your cell phone constantly. So in theory, you can tell if there's four people in a car because you can
we
count.
We all have our own
because
devices.
Because who doesn't have their device with them? And what good is that data in real time? Then is the idea you could maybe sync that with the traffic light and let it be green longer?
That's definitely the direction we're headed, right? So right now our first step is getting the devices up and seeing how it helps the city in more real-time specific scenarios like special events, right? Think Sundance traffic or big ski resort days. How to manage traffic more efficiently in that scenario. Where to deploy police officers, how to deploy them if at all, how to manage crowds in large areas, those sorts of scenarios. But eventually we're headed to a system where we can actually take control of traffic lights. Help synchronize in real time, basically.
So, and that's where I was going. And Matt, I was going to ask you, in your ideal scenario, how could we better manage our traffic? What would be the if you had a magic wand, what would be the infrastructure and the information you'd have in place to help us with days like we had in late December last year?
Oh, I mean, that's definitely out of my scope in my job. So, like, our traffic and transit teams are much better at that. And my role in this project is to help integrate their technology into our economic development teams, into our parking teams, into our transit teams, so that we're all working with this data and getting the data we need so we can understand, you know, what the contractor's daily life looks like. And I don't mean a specific contractor, but, like, people who work in town, what is their pattern? People who visit town, what is their pattern? you know, what are residents' patterns, generally speaking, so we can figure out how to best optimize parking, how to best optimize traffic, how to best optimize Main Street, just all these different systems we have in very limited space. We all know how small Park City is.
Going back to our first guest, Dan Ward, with his book, The Simplicity Cycle, this sounds like something that could get very complicated very fast. You could generate an awful lot of data. In crazy amounts of data. And it is a simple little town with only a few streets. How do you have a method devised yet, or is that ongoing, as to how you crunch all that data in a short amount of in real time?
Yeah. So Blinksy is an IBM-supported company. We run off IBM servers all over the country. We have a large backhaul and system that can deal with this data. We're expecting that. We generate millions of rows of data per day, and that system only grows the more devices there are and the more information we're collecting. And that's exactly what we do, right? We're a big data and analytics company. That's our job. It's our job to know how to do that and do that effectively, and that's exactly the space we're in and what we've been doing.
It's a good question, Larry. Things get complex very quickly. You mentioned you're an IBM-backed company. There was a big, I don't know if it was a contest last summer, several hundred companies. Tell us how you got involved there and where Blinksy ended up. And then you have some roots here in Park City as well with Pando Lab. So tell us about IBM and then tell us about your Park City roots.
Yeah, so we won the IBM Smart Camp out of Denver last summer, a large competition, startup competition. We were kind of competing against other teams in the space, what they're doing, what they're not doing from all across the entire West. Everyone converged on Denver to business plan competitions, pitch events, that kind of thing. And we walked out of there as a winner. We're very happy with that. We're also, like Doug said, IBM supported, running off the IBM Global Entrepreneur System, having free services, cloud infrastructure, those sorts of things. And that's really set us up in a really good position to do what we do here in Park City now. And our roots, of course, are closely in Park City. We work closely with Pando Labs, with the director there, Chad McAleer, and also with some of the Park City Angels here in the local area who've invested in us and care deeply about what we're doing and how we're doing.
And I should disclose, I think I'm the only Park City Angel that invested in you guys. And it was very early days, and it was actually Pando Labs that introduced me to you. Very promising entrepreneur. We're running low on cash and had a team that you needed to keep on board. So it just took a little bit of cash to keep you going. And now you're backed by two relatively large venture capital firms here in Utah, Pelion and Peterson Partners. And Larry, we've talked about Pando Labs, which is this shared workspace. It gives entrepreneurs access to not just office space. You didn't use the office space, but gives you access to mentors. And access to the angel community, and it just shows the value of stuff like that.
A lot of startups are spinning out of that successfully.
It's a really good thing. Matt, back to you. So what is the goal this summer? What would you like to see come out of the Blinksy project? This is just a relatively short-term test drive, if you will, of the technology, right?
Yeah, we've got a one-year pilot, and Blinksy's been really cooperative in being in a pilot phase with us and really adaptive to the data we need. So our goal is to get a full season's worth of data, see if it's meeting the needs of our various departments, and looking out into the future to see if that's what we want to continue with. We invest a lot in these studies annually and over the course of time. So if Blinksy has a role long term, we'd love to, you know, kick the tires, see what happens.
And Mark, tell us about, I know the University of Utah is, to use Matt's phrase, kicking the tires with Blinksy technology as well. I think they're further down the curve, though. Tell us how the University of Utah and the track system is using your technology.
Yeah, so the University of Utah was our first customer ever. A lot of support for innovation and entrepreneurship at the university when I was a student, when the company was started especially. And the university was really interested in understanding traffic in the stadium parking lot, now in Pac-12 school. Lots of interest in how football games were going to run and how that's going to work. That was our first pilot back in December. We successfully ran that for a few months, figuring out when people are coming to campus, how long they're staying on campus, where they're parking, that sort of thing. And that's direct insight for us, and we're now working closely with the University of Utah and UTA to potentially deploy a system to help them understand what the traffic flow looks like on tracks, on buses, those sorts of metrics, how to get to campus.
Great. Okay, well, we thank both of you for coming in this morning. Our guests have been Mark Pittman, CEO of Blinksy, and Matt Abbott, who's an environmental project engineer for Park City Municipal. Obviously, traffic is on everybody's radar screen here in Park City, and I'm glad to to see hear not just about this project, but the other things. This is a very important project to the municipal government as well, as it should be. So thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about that big building at the top of Main Street, the Treasure Mountain Inn, celebrating its golden anniversary. Can you believe that? After this.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back, and over the weekend, a fun event took place at Treasure Mountain Inn. I went along with, I think, more people, Andy Bierman, than you thought were going to come. An awful lot of people who came off the historic home tour and then sat in on a little session you hosted that talked about the Treasure Mountain Inn. And let me introduce Andy Bierman, usually here in his role as a city councilman, but today he's in as a proprietor along with your business partner and life partner, Thea Leonard, as owners of the Treasure Mountain Inn, and celebrating 50 years on Main Street. And, you know, you look at a building like that with angular lines, looks very modern. It's hard to believe that's a half-century-old building.
It is. It is. It's a big milestone for us, and we were excited to have our event this weekend and to have such great turnout. We didn't know so many people cared.
Well, you know, the thing I had always heard about Treasure Mountain Inn, which was built in 64-65 at the start of the ski era, as really the first modern lodging because before that, Park City had no infrastructure to host skiers on overnight visits. What's really interesting is that this was a condominium project, and that was a new animal, not just in Utah, but in America.
Yeah, it was. It was a brand new idea. They credit Keith Romney of the Romney fame. He was a lawyer in out of Salt Lake, and he came up with this model. And they actually, there's a doppelganger to Treasure Mountain Inn built down near Highland Avenue in Salt Lake, and it's a senior community. And they built it. They built it for seniors. It was 50 and over. They were allowing that, and their tagline was "No more yard work." They were figuring out a way that seniors could own a property, live together, and not have to manage that. That worked well in Salt Lake, and they came up here and used the same model for the Treasure Mountain Inn.
On the East Coast, there were co-op apartments, but condominiums, where you owned the space inside of a building, was a totally new animal in the country. And TMI was the first one at a resort, and really only the second one in the country, it sounds like. And Tom Clyde told a funny story, which was about his as a young lad, his dad grousing about this building and how what are people buying? They're buying air, and you know, what bank is going to loan on somebody who's buying a space of air inside of a bigger building, and yet it's all worked out, and now there are condominiums everywhere in the world. So talk a little bit about how and why Treasure Mountain Inn got started back in 64.
Well, starting at the beginning, the ski area at that point was Treasure Mountain Ski Area. So I believe some wealthy investors from Salt Lake looked at our market and said, we think the ski economy might take off, and they wanted to develop a hotel to go with that. At that point, there were no modern hotels in Park City. This was the first one, and they had their choice of locations, really. And so they took, it was 26 city lots on Main Street and built it right there. And to some degree, it was an idea ahead of its time. It never thrived in the way that they had hoped. There were a lot of celebrities that came here. A lot of people used the hotel, but it really only had a few glory years before things started to fade off and newer, nicer properties came into place. And the ski economy grew to the point where it could support hotels year-round.
And has it been in continuous operation, or during some of these hard years did it go dark for a while?
I would say there was almost 20 years in there where it was relatively dark. There were always people staying there, but Thea arrived here in 1993. She came from New Paltz, where she worked F&B at a five-star resort, and she came out here specifically to help her father operate it as a hotel. And she describes it as the lights were pretty much turned off and the carpet hadn't been replaced since it opened when she got there. So she really kicked off the idea of renovating it and putting some vibrancy back into it so it could do nightly rentals again.
So you are proprietor with Thea and no doubt other investors of Treasure Mountain Inn, but it is a condominium hotel.
It is.
So what exactly do you own? Let's talk a little bit about the business model. What is the business of running the Treasure Mountain Inn?
It is. Thea and I, we are sole owners of the property management company that runs it like a hotel. We do the meetings and conventions, and we do the reservations, do the maintenance for the rooms. We are approximately a 30% owner of the overall property, if you look at the real estate. And we have acquired units, bought and sold units over the years as the markets fluctuated. Our initial chunk we bought from David Leonard, who was Thea's father, who was a pilot and used to vacation out here. And as the economy was poor through the years, he would occasionally pick up condominiums. So we got our starting piece from him, and then we've acquired other pieces since.
So the revenues for the hotel are you rent the commercial spaces,
mm-hmm.
you rent for banquets, weddings, that sort of thing. And then as a management company, you get a percentage of the income when you rent a private owner's suite.
Yep, exactly. It's a standard model that you see all over town. What's a little bit different is that Thea and I are owners of real estate and operators. And to be honest, we started the property management company, or the nightly rental aspect, to pair mortgages to help cover the condominiums. And we weren't sure how it was going to do, but having a unique location on Main Street and having the only conference rooms in the downtown, it really has thrived over the years.
And so I moved here 10 years ago, and just in the last 10 years, I've seen us go from really kind of winter main focused, and then I would say the tourist business was okay, but it wasn't thriving in the summer like it is now. What do you think has driven the summer business? What do you think we as a city were doing 10 years ago to kind of build that up? And what do you think we need to be focusing on today so that 10 years from now it continues to thrive?
Well, I've been here over 20 years, and when I first got here, I think golf was one of the main summer activities, and we had a couple of big events like the Arts Festival. Certainly events have grown. We've probably tripled the number of big summer events we do and added things like the Park City Market that have really helped summer business. Mountain biking has something that's taken off in town. Locals used to like to bike here, but now people come from all over the world. Certainly we do a lot more with cultural events as well, and all that continues to fuel our summer business. And I think it's actually hit a point where there's a bit of a tipping point in the community where a lot of folks are going, can we back off a little bit? We don't have any weekends to ourselves.
There is some event weariness you hear about these days.
So I think that the community is having a conversation on that now, and I think you'll see us be much more choosy. We used to be at the point where we'd take any event, and we'd hope more would come in. We're at the point now where I think we're going to pick and choose what events we host in the future. And we've also seen the off-season stretch. When we first in the late 90s and early 2000s, Thea and I would shut the hotel down for at least a month to 6 weeks, both in the fall and the spring, and we couldn't imagine doing that anymore. We're pretty much booked year-round, with November maybe being the one exception. November seems to be a dead month here, and you know, it's a great month to get out of town, go to the desert, or go someplace warm.
Indeed. Part of my function is to ask the difficult questions, the impolite questions. So I guess that question would be, it is so big. It's out of character for what Main Street is today.
Yep.
And you know, you can never get away from the fact that it is a very large building on a street of mostly one and two-story buildings. What can you do and what have you done to kind of make the visual impact of the building more attractive? Everybody used to pick on Main Street Mall.
Yep.
Now Main Street Mall has been chopped up and made into a smaller looking spaces. What do you do to try to bring visual appeal to the Treasure Mountain Inn?
That's a great question, and it's a challenge because the building is so large. It's the largest building on Main Street, so anything we do has to be replicated four stories high and over 200 feet long, which means it's expensive. But over the years, we've tried to do what we can with the property. It's definitely an aesthetic from the 60s, and it doesn't integrate well with the street. But we have we've put a glass elevator and sort of staggered porches on the north end, which is the main view coming up the street. We've used some paint treatments. We've improved the balconies and put a porte cochere and an entry on it. And we're actually looking at other ideas. What I think would really add vibrancy is if we could put some commercial on the ground level where our parking garage is, because then you wouldn't have that void on the street. Unfortunately, we've got a 200-foot void as people come up the street because there's nothing but a parking garage at ground level, and it's kind of a funky Alice in Wonderland walk as it gets smaller as you go up there.
Yeah.
So we've looked at potentially putting some kiosks out there, or maybe at some point converting more of the garage space to commercial, but that's always challenging because there's parking restrictions.
Because you need the garage.
Exactly. Well, actually, one of the things we're proud of is we don't use the garage very much. We've pushed hard the last decade to be a carless property. And if you go in there peak season, our garage is almost empty. The only people really parking in there are our employees.
And you know, we'll have to just let you touch on this, but I know you're proud of it and deservedly so. But we just have a minute left to talk briefly about your green initiatives, because you have really taken the lead in turning an old property into a green property.
Yeah, it's something we're proud of. It adds a lot of meaning to our business, and it's something Thea and I care deeply about. But we started out with recycling, and that's expanded to a huge commitment to renewable energy, both on-site and through purchasing credits. We're a carbon-neutral property. We give a percentage of all of our profits to environmental organizations, both around town and nationally, which over the last decade has added up to about $200,000 we've been able to contribute to these causes. Use all recycled materials. We were one of the first properties to try to go paperless in our transactions. We've made big changes in our waste stream in terms of, instead of having two dumpsters empty daily, we now do one dumpster three times a week. The list goes on, and if anybody's curious about it, they're welcome to give us a call or go on our website and see there's probably 50 different things we do to try to reduce our impact on the environment.
It's important to have that leadership, so thanks for doing that. I remember when in the 10 years I've been here, we went from the big garbage can being your daily, your weekly garbage to your every other week recycling and having to get your garbage down to a small can. And at first, I was really against that. But, you know, you get used to it and you learn to recycle more. And all of a sudden now, my garbage can is only half full. And it takes leaders like yourself to inspire us to say, okay, we'll give this a shot. And then you just have to live with it for a couple of years. But it makes a difference.
Yeah, so hats off to you and Thea for doing that. And congratulations to both of you for 50 years now of the Treasure Mountain Inn on Main Street.
Thanks very much, and thanks to all the community that came out to celebrate with us this weekend.
And when we come back, we will wrap up Mountain Money for this Monday.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake, info at hideoutcanyon.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Beppler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Yeah, welcome back to Mountain Money. Interesting conversations, as we always strive to have on Mountain Money. Thanks to Dan Ward with the Simplicity Cycle book, Mark Pittman from Blinksy, and Matt Abbott from the city, and then Andy Bierman celebrating 50 years at the Treasure Mountain.
Yeah, I also want to thank Beth Fracken, for our producer of the show, for lining up such great guests for us week in and week out. We also want to thank the Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Designs, and Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough, the sponsors of this show. Thank you for sponsoring our show. We couldn't do it without underwriters like you.
Indeed, we appreciate that. Next week on Mountain Money, we're going to some of our favorite guests, the editors of Consumer Reports magazine. They're out with a cover story on products made in America. And it's nice to know
they do a great job. That's always a good conversation.
Yeah, that more stuff is coming on shore that we used to ship away. So we'll have that. And also a big transaction on Main Street, the Imperial Hotel sold to the River Horse Group. We'll have Seth Adams from River Horse explaining what they'll be doing to the Imperial Hotel. Thanks for joining us. We're headed to a high of 81 today. This is KPCW in Park City. Thanks for joining us on Mountain Money. Time for the news.